You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with and requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee will meet twice in September via public video conference. The Finance Committee will meet on Thursday, September 7th at 5:30 p.m. and again Thursday, September 21st at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Stories I've Told the Stars, Friday, September 22nd, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts in Portland. Stories I've Told the Stars is a short documentary that features the stories of three men who left their homes in Ethiopia in the 80s to escape civil war. They share stories of their experiences as refugees, their journey to the United States, and their resettlement in the Pacific Northwest. Stories I've Told the Stars will show Friday, September 22nd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts, 511 Northwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media, and I'm so proud to announce the inaugural episode of this program, keeping the spirit of the original show and enhanced by the framing of Yes Magazine, a solutions journalism media outlet. This week, as auto workers prepare for a potential strike, we'll speak with labor specialist Cedric De Leon about UAW and how its demands for a major pay bump and a four-day work week are part of a people-centered economic model. Then we'll turn to Chicago-based climate organizer Justin Blake, he's also the CEO of Black Underground Recycling, about the upcoming march to end fossil fuels taking place in New York City on September 17th. He'll explain why he's participating and what he hopes to achieve. Finally, Liz Giel, partner and co-founder of The Coven, will join me to discuss the results of a new study on how anti-LGBTQ laws are impacting workers, particularly transgender and gender-expansive workers, and what employers can do to create a more affirming workplace. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Auto workers are readying themselves for a potential strike as contract negotiations with the so-called Big Three drag on. The United Auto Workers is negotiating on behalf of nearly 150,000 workers at Detroit-based auto manufacturing plants run by Ford, GM, and Stellantis NV. On the face of it, UAW's demands sound audacious. A 46% pay raise and a 4-day work week, among other things. But given the decades-long decline in labor rights and wages, is it unreasonable? Joining me to help answer that question is Cedric De Leon, Professor of Sociology and Labor Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where up until recently he was the director of the UMass Amherst Labor Center. He's also the author of several books, including Crisis, When Political Parties Lose the Consent to Rule, and The Origins of Right to Work. Welcome to the program, Cedric.
Thanks, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what it is that's at stake here. These are very trying times for most of us in the United States. Although wages are up, inflation is up even higher. And auto workers are working long hours, working very hard, and they've made a lot of concessions in previous union negotiations over the years, right? So in a way, they've been sort of set back.
Yes, they have been. And I think that overall, this labor struggle is tied to all the other labor struggles that we've been seeing in the last few years, because we're really living through what I call the crisis of neoliberalism, in which basically corporate profits have gone sky high with no attempt to redistribute any of the wealth to the working class here in this country and elsewhere. And so the demands of the membership of the United Auto Workers, I think, are well in line with the realities of present day capitalism, in which for now, probably I would say a generation or two, the employers have been making money hand over fist, while workers have just basically been trailing behind. And not only that, you mentioned that there are now only 150,000 UAW members. Of course, that number is much smaller than what the UAW was just a generation ago. And so, you know, these workers are fighting for their lives, and they're no longer content with the status quo of neoliberal capitalism.
So let's talk about what it is that they are actually demanding. I mentioned a 46% pay raise. And of course, the headlines sensationalize that. And, you know, anybody who's reading that might think, well, that sounds unreasonable. And that's exactly what Ford and GM have said. Is it unreasonable?
Right. I don't think that a 46% increase is unreasonable at all when you think about just how much UAW members have lost over the years. So just to give you some perspective on this, in the middle of the 20th century, 80,000 workers worked at one plant in Michigan called the River Rouge plant. And now there are only 150,000 members total within the UAW bargaining unit, working for the big three automakers. So what we're talking about here is just massive deindustrialization and unemployment on the part of these workers. And this is to say nothing of the fact that the boss has extracted massive wage concessions from these workers over time, and recently instituted what's called a two-tier hiring system, in which new workers are brought in to the company at a much lower pay rate and also without access to a pension. And so that is part of the negotiations this year also. The UAW membership and leadership want to do away with this two-tier system and make sure that all workers have access to the rights and privileges of union membership.
So when we think about it in that broader context, of course, then the 46% pay raise may make so much more sense. And also they're asking, as you said, for a removal of the tiered system. But they're also asking for a four-day work week, which is an idea that has caught hold around the country. So far, it's been sort of, you know, more elite workers, white-collar workers who've been able to take advantage of this idea of a 32-hour work week. But there have been studies done showing that it can actually, you know, result in no loss of productivity, et cetera. What do you make of this UAW demand? And, you know, is it in line with a transition to a green energy economy? Because electric vehicles, which are the wave of the future, require less labor to produce to begin with.
Yeah, I think that this is a very old idea, actually. It goes back to the 8-hour day, and the idea is basically to spread work around under conditions of mass unemployment. Whatever the numbers may suggest, there are still millions of workers in the United States and around the world who are jobless. As a matter of fact, there are countries in the world in which there's an entire generation of young people who have never known formal sector employment. And so it heartens me to hear that the UAW is asking for a shorter work week. It's something that that auto workers in places like France and Germany have been able to win. And as you suggest, you know, it doesn't actually lead to a drop off in productivity. If anything, it increases productivity because workers are more alert, more satisfied, and ready to go for the amount of hours that they're there to work. And it also, I think, spreads the wealth and redistributes the privileges of formal sector employment to a wider sector of the working class.
When we think about the fact that these big automakers are looking at a potential windfall around electric vehicles, we also, you know, I'm wondering if you think that the Biden administration can do something about that. I mean, we just, as part of, I believe it was the Inflation Reduction Act, saw the announcement of a $15.5 billion fund toward EV production, which could be passed on to workers. It is, you know, certainly the direction that the industry is going in, but it seems as though the automakers, you know, they don't want to necessarily pass on these the benefits of these transitions to workers, and they're more interested in, say, bonuses rather than increased salaries. Isn't it a sort of win-win-win for automakers, workers, and our climate if we had a transition to EVs and workers' rights commensurate?
Yes,
with
I mean,
that transition?
Yes, I think that that's right. But what the UAW wants, and I think it is a reasonable demand, is a just transition. We do have to save our planet, and there's no reason why we can't have both a sustainable economy and a working class that earns a living wage. And so the Biden administration, I think, can help with this particular part of the workers' demands, because what we're talking about here is an economy in which electric vehicles will require a third less labor. And of course, as we were discussing earlier, you know, the membership of the UAW at this point has dwindled from past highs to now roughly about 160,000 members. The UAW can't take a drop in membership by a third. And so they're looking for assurances that I think, as you suggest, the Biden administration can help with, right? These employers don't have the resources or the political will to provide a social safety net for workers who might be affected in terms of employment from this transition to electrical vehicles. They don't have the resources to retrain workers to move to a different industry. And I think also that the Biden administration could be pivotal in negotiating other parts of the auto industry where these workers who would be displaced by automation and the creation of electric vehicles could go so that they can maintain their lives and their families.
Now, how have the automakers responded so far? It seems as though they've waited till the very last minute. Contracts expire September 14th for the big three, Stellantis, NV, Ford, and GM. And they have made some proposals. The UAW president, Sean Fain, was not impressed. I believe it was Ford's proposal that he threw in the trash and, you know, called another, I think, Stellantis' proposal insulting. They seem to be waiting till the very last minute. And if they do, of course, fail to deliver, we could see this huge strike, right?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, this is the result in part of a change in leadership at the United Auto Workers. There was an establishment board that was ousted by a progressive insurgent slate of leaders who was sick and tired of the concessions that the union had given to the big three automakers in the past. And so, you know, what we have now in leadership, and I think this is broadly reflective of the sentiments of the rank and file membership, is an appetite to fight, a sentiment that we're not going to take these concessions anymore. We've been moving backwards now for many years. We want to move forward. So, for example, the existing employer proposal for wage increases is 10% in the first year, which of course doesn't come close to the 46% number that we've been discussing. And the workers are really for the first time actually in labor history, seeking to actually strike all three automakers at the same time if they don't receive a contract that they believe is adequate given all of the backsliding of these many years.
So if these companies don't give in to the union leadership, if the union goes on strike, what sort of impact are we looking at? I've seen estimates into the billions, you know, $5 billion economic loss on both sides with just 10 days of striking. And we have some historical data to look at as well, right? I believe it was Ford, where workers struck just a few years ago. And there were billions of dollars in losses. So first of all, what sort of losses could there be? And second of all, couldn't they just spend the money up front on paying the workers and avoid losses over a few months? You know, spread it out over several years and pay them more.
That's exactly right, Sonali. I mean, these employers are staring down the barrel of a gun with a certain price tag. I don't have any better information than the information that the company, the union, and industry analysts have projected, and so rather than flush $5 billion down the drain, let's come to the table with serious proposals that can meet the demands of these workers who certainly deserve what they're asking for, and then some. The fact of the matter is, Sonali, that it has to cost. There has to be pain on the other side of a strike. That is what withholding your labor power is meant to make the boss think, right? The whole point of threatening a job action is to make the boss do a calculus. What will it cost to settle with these workers, and what will it cost if I don't, right? And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the workers are trying to make the argument here that it's going to cost a lot more to be obstructionist than to give us what we want. So I think cost is certainly central to this entire struggle. And I agree with you, Sonali, that the solution is rather than flush that money down the toilet, give it to working class people.
Let's also broadly talk about unions and their popularity. We are at a moment when there is a massive labor resurgence for various reasons that we can go into, and many analyses have been written about. But how important is that context for this potential UAW strike, that we're seeing more and more Americans realizing that corporations don't care about you, that you have to push them if you actually want to make a decent wage, and that if we just sort of sit back and let them set our wages, it just simply doesn't work. Is the broader context crucial here?
Yes, it is crucial. I think that we can think about what is going on in the UAW as being of a piece with the larger resurgence nationally. You know, in the UAW, as we just discussed, a progressive faction took over the leadership of that union. And that also happened with the Teamsters, where the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, who were sick of the concessions that the union was handing over to the employers over many years, essentially said enough of that. We know for a fact that the membership wants more. They want a better life, and so we're going to lead the union in that particular direction. I think this kind of churn in the leadership from conservative to progressive factions is part of labor's resurgence, and I think also just the wave of organizing at iconic brands that had never before been unionized. Such as Amazon, Starbucks, Trader Joe's, Apple, and many others are part of that wave too. And certainly in the public sector, we've seen we saw teachers and paraprofessionals beginning in 2018 fight back, even in conservative red states, and win, and not take no for an answer, as you suggest, Sonali, and say, you know, we're not going to let these Republican legislatures dictate to us how much we as paraprofessionals and teachers are going to make. And so I think the what's going on in the UAW today is part of a larger insurgency on the part of the American working class to say enough is enough, we're not going to take it anymore.
And it's not just the leadership being more militant with employers. They also seem to be more militant with the Democratic Party, right? Sean Fain, the leader of the UAW, has yet to endorse Joe Biden for re-election, in spite of the fact that Biden is, at least on paper, an extremely pro-union president. And even actually when it comes to brass tacks, has made it much easier for unions in terms of the NLRB siding with unions, as it should. But still, I think Sean Fain seemed upset that Biden remarked he wasn't sure whether the auto workers would go on strike or not. He wasn't pro-union enough for Fain. That's kind of a change as well, right?
Yes, that's right. I think that Fain's refusal to commit at this time is the result of at least two things. First of all, we're on the eve of a strike. And as we know, workers, even in unions, are politically polarized. A majority of union members in the United States still vote for the Democratic Party, but a large number of them are either swing voters or are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans at this point. And so, you know, if if they were to endorse Biden on the eve of the strike, that might create partisan conflict where he doesn't want any just prior to leading the membership out on strike. So I think that that's a tactical consideration on his part. I also think that, you know, because this is a progressive faction now leading the United Auto Workers, I would say that, you know, the conversation about political independence is a very old song among progressive trade unionists. And the argument goes something like this: you know, we have been in bed with the Democratic Party now at least since 1936, if not before. And what have we gotten for it? We've gotten deindustrialization, globalization, mass unemployment, and deunionization. So perhaps we ought to consider a politically independent route. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if that conversation was happening, you know, in meetings in the UAW and in unions across the country. That's a real, let's say, ideological divide within the labor movement. It's longstanding. And so in that respect, I think also that this is it may be coming from that kind of streak among progressives within the labor movement.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Cedric. We'll see what happens after September 14th when the contracts expire. Really appreciate your insight and analysis.
You're very welcome, Sonali.
My guest has been Cedric De Leon, Professor of Sociology and Labor Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify, and we're on social media at RU with Sonali. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. This summer, more heat-related records were broken. Hurricanes and major floods caused severe damage, and wildfires devastated towns. Still, President Joe Biden, who has promised to be proactive on climate justice, has refused to declare a climate emergency, saying that he has, quote, practically already done so. On Sunday, September 17, thousands of climate activists plan to descend on New York City for the March to End Fossil Fuels. The march takes place days before the United Nations Climate Ambition Summit in the city. Joining me now is Justin Blake, a Chicago-based climate activist who plans to attend the March to End Fossil Fuels. He's also the CEO of Black Underground Recycling. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Assalamu alaikum, sis. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, tell me how you've been participating as a climate activist before we get into what's happening September 17th. What is your commitment on the issue of climate change? Why is it important to you?
Well, my name is Justin Blake. I'm the uncle of Jacob Blake that was shot 7 times in the back right after George Floyd down in Kenosha. And we've been fighting for social justice for quite some time prior to our nephew getting shot. And we believe, like Martin Luther believed, that Vietnam was connected to civil rights and there was no difference between the two. We believe that climate justice has to do with social justice. And therefore, right after we were fighting diligently down in West Kenosha, Wisconsin. We were asked to participate in a 22-day water fast. We were trying to get a bill signed in Madison, Wisconsin that would have really made a difference and had a great impact on climate and on the African-American community in regards to jobs and insulating their homes and raising the quality of their life. And so we jumped on board of the Kenosha 7 and fasted for 22 days, lost over 45 pounds. And that is our commitment. We are as committed to climate justice as we are to social justice.
Tell me what is happening on September 17th in New York City. You plan on being there alongside what may hope to be thousands of others?
We are ecstatic. We just left D.C. Participating in a protest in front of the White House with Kai Newkirk. Thank you. I'm so sorry. Great brother, very active. We'll be in New York with Climate Defiance, who we always roll with. Those are some young people, exciting, challenging the president to stick to his word to get our country off fossil fuels, to declare climate, you know, that this is a climate area in which we do not want to be in. Once they do that, they will come with the resources that they do as if they were having a war. We've declared war on other issues. We need to declare war. Our president needs to declare war on climate change.
What do you make of the fact that Joe Biden has said he has practically declared a climate emergency? And you know, certainly on some issues, he is better than his predecessors in terms of investing in green energy. Yet, of course, he's also approved new drilling permits, unlike, you know, even more so than his predecessors. So he seems to be a mixed bag on the climate, right?
Totally. We had the benefit of bumping into Buttigieg at the airport in D.C. and rode back with him to Chicago.
This is Pete Buttigieg, our transportation secretary?
That is correct. That is correct. And we had a conversation. You can't be sort of pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. Either we're in climate, we're seeing a climate change that we've never seen before, or we're not. And you have to commit 105% to fighting climate change. You can't sit on the fence and on this issue, or there won't be a planet sooner than later. And so, yeah, they've made, president has made some starts, but we believe they're beholden to the oil barons and the people that bring coal out of the ground. And we need to be, this country needs to be the head, the lead, the tip of the spear in regards to green jobs and how we turn our whole economic situation around relying upon green energy instead of fossil fuels.
Now, when we think about the activism that has happened in the past, there have been so many marches, there have been so much activism. You know, there's different geographic places that people gather. Some young people are suing the government. Others do do civil disobedience. And, you know, we'll have massive marches all the way from Washington, D.C. to California. Why do you think September 17th would be any different from the previous ones? Or, you know, how do you respond to the fact that sometimes it doesn't seem on the surface to make a difference?
Well, we believe we're at a very life-changing point in our country's history. There is no going back. We have passed the 11th hour and we can no longer play with this issue. We're depending and relying upon the people that come to the streets to continue to put pressure on this administration. It's not just the people hitting the streets, it's the people hitting the streets that have millions and thousands of people that can't be there, that they rely upon these people to continue to voice our opinion that we're not doing with the leadership that this country could do in regards to the world climate, that if we step up and put our foot down, we have countries, smaller countries. Germany's really going full force into trying to become green. Other smaller countries are trying to spend all their efforts in trying to become green. If we're going to continue to be, quote unquote, the greatest country on the planet, then we need to be leading the green movement. I watched one of the ambassadors who I used to like on TV the other day trying to spin that we should rely upon India and China making movements first. It's irrelevant what other countries do. It's relevant what our country does. Therefore, the people that march are not just marching in the conversation ended with Buttigieg, with us saying that if we could please set up a meeting where we could come sit down with you and you could better understand the issues that we're trying to illuminate to the people. He returns to the jet plane after he got on his little scooter to go to his limo that I'm sure was awaiting him, came back to give us his car so we can set up some type of meeting, because just like at the end of the Irish war that was going on, they had to finally sit down and settle some things down. The end of the civil rights, we had to sit down with the president and work some things out. This is no different. At some point, after marching, after bringing all these issues to the table, we're going to have to sit down with people in his administration and help them cross the line into a better, cleaner, greener United States of America.
In addition to the September 17th march taking place in New York City, I understand on the 18th there's going to be actions around civil disobedience. Tell me about, you know, if you were to try to convince someone to come out to New York City, you know, maybe they're driving distance because it might be a little bit late to fly out. What would you tell them? How would you convince them to come to the march to end fossil fuels and the actions that are taking place even after?
Well, I would just merely point out to them that you only live once. There's many people that say, hey, man, I wish I could have, would have marched with Martin Luther King, or I would have, could have been there with Gandhi or other extraordinary history changing events. You only go around once, and you have the opportunity to be part of the solution and pushing our country into a better, cleaner society. This is your opportunity. Please come join us. It's going to be an extraordinary historical event, and you would not want to miss it. If you are a person that breathes air, this affects you. If you are a person that drinks water, this affects you. So there's nobody that can say, this issue doesn't really affect me. It does, and it will. So we have a time and an opportunity, thank goodness, to our great leadership through Michael at Climate Defiance and many other organizations that have gotten together to get the boots on the ground and the people in the streets. But don't sit back any longer. We have to fight systemic racism. We have to fight climate change, and we have to all do it together.
What do you say around the issue of civil disobedience versus marching and protesting? You've been arrested before. You've been active and, you know, put yourself in harm's way. And we know that especially for people of color and for Black people, being in an arena where one can get arrested and face police arrest is potentially extremely life-risking.
Yeah, well, when you want change, you have to risk, you know, sort of like not a gamble, I don't want to say, but if you want change, you have to put forth certain efforts and you make other people understand that you are so committed, this thing must change. So, you know, we have people like a badass grandma who was literally just drugged through court defending Line 5. They want to put oil up under our lakes. Are we out of our mind? We're going to risk our fresh water for somebody else to make some money. When it goes bad, our water would be wrecked and we won't be able to drink out of the water. We won't be able to use that water to bear fruit, to bear vegetables, to help feed the cattle, those that eat meat, and et cetera. So we have to protect it with our life or there will be no life. So it's a serious issue.
Justin, can you tell me a little bit more about Black Underground Recycling? You're the CEO of this company. What does it do? How does it align with your work on the climate?
Well, it basically, we are trying to lower the carbon footprint of Chicago via working through different communities and reaching out to the suburbs as well. We use the money to feed our senior citizens, to feed the homeless. We use this to use it to prevent violence in our community. We use it to stimulate jobs. of construction jobs, recycling jobs, and so forth. So we, as African Americans, if we can mitigate climate defiance, then there's no other problem that we can resolve in our community.
And where can people find out more about your work, Justin?
They can reach out to 773-412-8098, which is our personal number, or you can go online and look at the Black Underground Recycling, see the many works that we've been doing around Chicago for 7+ years. And this will be the year that we stand the Black Underground Recycling up. We will be recycling from Chicago to Milwaukee and every community in between. We're going to show you how recycling can rebuild a community and make access to jobs. That's what our president should be defining, that in the midst of this change, how many jobs it will create. Windmills, the turbines, the solar, all different kind of ways there will be jobs created for those who desperately need them. So not only are we changing and correcting our atmosphere that's been damaged severely, we're providing jobs with people in the community that gives people the thrust and the belief that they can change their own community. That's our general basis.
So basically, Black Underground Recycling is the sort of defines the idea of green jobs, and you're putting it into practice.
Right. Well, I mean, everybody's talking, but you have to be able to show people how this affects them, good on the good side and on the bad side. So if we can lessen our carbon footprints, I can't imagine how many tons, but we're doing a study out of how many tons we've recycled over 7 years or plus, and how that's lessened the carbon footprint in the African-American community, in the city of Chicago, and the state of Illinois. If it's good for us, it's good and great for everybody else as well, because we all breathe the same air and we all drink the same water.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Justin, again, for joining us. Good luck to you with your company. Good luck on Sunday at the March to End Fossil Fuels. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having us. Everybody, please come out. And if you can't come out, tune in, check Climate Defiance page, and they will give you information. Thank you again to Kai Newkirk for allowing us to participate in this protest in D.C. We got to protest everywhere we are until we get what we need.
Thank you.
RVG
again.
All the way down. Thank you. All right.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Justin Blake, Chicago-based climate activist, CEO of Black Underground Recycling. He's going to attend the March to End Fossil Fuels taking place in New York City on September 17th. And we'll post links to that from risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. As GOP politicians bank on homophobic and transphobic rhetoric, policies, and laws to score political points and garner votes, a new study examines the impact that such legislation has on gender-expansive workers. It turns out that the vast majority of such workers feel that anti-transgender laws affect their mental health. More than half say the increase in anti-LGBTQ laws impact their ability to do their jobs. What can workplaces do to improve the environment for gender-expansive workers? My guest is Liz Giel, co-founder of The Coven and also a partner with The Coven. She's the lead author of the study. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So first, let's talk about the study itself. In the context of everything that's happening in this country, how did you go about surveying workers? And maybe even give us a note toward the language that you use, gender expansive as opposed to, you know, straight up LGBTQ.
Absolutely. So as part of this study, we were interested in really understanding how the LGBTQ community is experiencing this rise in anti-LGBTQ legislation, just overall in their lives, but also at work. So as part of the study, we partnered with an organization that is near and dear to us called Mosher to really help us understand how to approach the study in an inclusive way, but also used very inclusive language as part of it. So as more people are exploring what gender looks like for them, we wanted to talk to folks who identify as non-binary and felt that, you know, gender expansive was really the most inclusive term that we could use for folks who don't necessarily identify as a man or as a woman. You know, this was very inclusive to us as for folks who are also transgender. So I'm really trying to understand those different experiences and folks who are expressing their gender differently. We felt that gender expansive was the best and most inclusive term for us to use, but also really encompassed the topic that we were aiming to learn about as part of this study.
So we have a situation right now where there are laws all the time being passed at the state level, especially in GOP-run states. I mentioned, you know, these are basically being used to score political points and whip up a frenzy. How important is this framing? And how, you know, we may think that it's just headlines, but I suppose when the headlines sort of are referencing one's right to exist, referencing laws that upend one's right to exist, even if there might be a headline in a different state, it really has an impact on people's mental health?
Absolutely. I think what we found in our study was a little bit surprising. I think we thought that folks who are gender expansive or transgender in some of the states, I think you're talking about the GOP led states that are introducing more of these anti-LGBTQ bills would be the ones most impacted by the rise in these hateful laws. But we found that because this is happening, it really extends beyond borders within the United States of America. So, you know, one example is the state where the Coven is headquartered in Minnesota. You know, by all standards, we are a quite progressive state as far as the laws that we are introducing. We are really, in a lot of respects, I would say, leading the charge nationally for laws that are creating more safe environments here in Minnesota for transgender and gender expansive people. However, we found that folks in our study that live in Minnesota are just as likely to be impacted by the rise in these hateful laws as folks in other more conservative states. So, you know, it really, it doesn't necessarily, there's not that exact correlation that we expected based on where people live. We find that these hateful laws are impacting gender expansive and transgender workers everywhere. And these people are very interested in seeing more support from their employers very specifically.
So let's talk about what you found in more detail. It's impacting their mental health. They do. One thing that surprised me was that 75% of workers identifying as gender expansive do feel welcomed, but don't mm-hmm. feel, or many don't feel, that their workplaces are doing enough to sort of combat the wave of legislation. That suggests to me that this is an important moment for where there's an expectation of change?
Absolutely. So one thing that we did in this study was include participants who work for companies nationally, so not necessarily only transgender or gender expansive employees. And the reason for that is we were trying to understand on a national level how our employers responding to this rise in anti-LGBTQ and anti-transgender legislation. So we found on the whole, a lot of folks would say that their workplace is welcoming for the LGBTQ community. This can look like a lot of different things. Maybe they have different events that they're sponsoring during June and Pride Month. But where we found a bit of a discrepancy is in the meaningful response to the rise in this hateful legislation and people feeling like their employers maybe could be doing more to support their transgender and gender expansive employees very specifically. And I think the important thing to note there is, beyond the clear impact to mental health, we do find that transgender and gender expansive employees are saying that the rise in this legislation is impacting their ability to do their jobs successfully. So whether employers like it or not, this is a workplace issue, and they do see opportunity for employers to take further action. One example that came up in the study was employers could be more proactive about having policies in place or procedures that would help their transgender and gender expansive employees understand areas where it may not be safe for them to travel, as just one example. So while many feel that their employer is taking action to support the LGBTQ community as a whole, there is more work to be done for transgender and gender expansive workers.
Is there geographic, or I don't know if your study was granular enough to figure out whether there was geographic difference in terms of impacts on mental health? For example, are transgender and gender expansive workers in Florida more deeply impacted than, say, those in Minnesota?
Yes, that's a great question. We did have respondents nationally as part of the study, and we were surprised to see that there is not necessarily a correlation between states that are introducing more of these anti-LGBTQ laws than states that are perhaps, alternatively introducing legislation that are sort of intended to protect the LGBTQ or transgender community. And I think part of the reason for that is really the national media. I think, again, folks in Minnesota are just as likely to see what's happening in Florida, what's happening in some other more conservative states. And that is having an impact on them, even if they don't live in those states. So there's not necessarily as strong of a correlation depending on geography that we would have expected. And for us, that was an important takeaway, that even workers in states that are introducing more protections for the gender expansive and transgender community are still impacted by what's happening in states that are not doing that. And as to be expected, people who are living in the more conservative states are certainly experiencing similar levels of trauma and concern for their own personal safety as folks in other states. Hmm.
So how can the results of this study be applied in the real world in service of justice? If you were to be able to give advice to employers who were concerned about, wanting to make all of their workers feel safe, feel welcomed, feel loved, what would you suggest that they do?
That's a great question. So one of the most important components of this study was asking LGBTQ respondents what actions are most meaningful to you of a long list of things that employers can do. What are the most meaningful for you as an LGBTQ worker? And so we do have a prioritized list based on input from workers nationally, and we organized the actions into a couple of different categories. The first one is visibility, so making sure that LGBTQ workers are able to show up as their authentic selves at work. So one example of this would be employers making it very simple for employees to have their pronouns in company communications as one example of visibility. We also had categories around safety and flourishing. So the example that I gave earlier, where employers may have an opportunity to provide guidance to their LGBTQ workers on areas where it is safe for them to travel or alternatively unsafe for them to travel, maybe one example of safety. But we also looked at flourishing and actions that employers can do, or policies that they can put in place to make sure that their LGBTQ workers are leading, you know, the best lives that they could possibly lead. So an example of that might be, maybe it's health insurance options that have, gender inclusive benefits as part of that, their health insurance package. It can be, it can really run the gamut from things like, health insurance to time off for gender transition and inclusive care. So there's really a long list of possibilities there. And I think it's important for employers to really understand from their workers or from workers nationally, what actions are most meaningful for them and what steps can they start to take to implement some of those actions that are in support of creating safer workplaces.
Does it seem to you to be effective for workplaces to also be a bit activist, if you will? I'm thinking about Disney in Florida, when Florida began passing very harmful legislation, especially against transgender people, and the so-called Don't Say Gay law. The company's LGBTQ workers were very upset that the company didn't take a strong enough stand, using its economic clout to sort of stand up to the state of Florida. Now, of course, most workplaces aren't as big and powerful as Disney, but do you think that it would impact the mental health of transgender and gender expansive workers to see their employers sort of go to bat for them, advocate for them?
Absolutely. We did find from the study that there is a desire for our LGBTQ workers nationally to see their employers take a more vocal stance about support for the community. The important thing to note there is they not only want them to take a vocal stance in support of the LGBTQ community, but of course they want to see meaningful action internally. So we did look at, what are the differences between, the distinction, I should say, between employers who are, verbalizing their support for the LGBTQ community publicly, but maybe not taking action internally to make that support real. So I think it's important for employers to know that, yes, your workers want you to use your influence in support of them to any degree possible, but to make sure that that support is not performative, that it is followed up by actions that are meaningful to your LGBTQ workers. So there definitely is a gap with employers who are, maybe publicly supporting the LGBTQ community, but not taking action internally. And that was very specifically what we wanted to study within this latest research. So you do start to see perhaps more and more companies, again, maybe they're hosting events during Pride Month or, creating advertising or marketing communications in support of the LGBTQ community in June. But the opportunity and the need is to support these workers year round.
Finally, Liz, tell me a little bit more about the Coven, what it is and how people can find out also about the study.
Absolutely. So the Coven is a shared workspace and a community that is designed for belonging. So we opened our first workspace in the Twin Cities 5 years ago and have now expanded to three with ambitions to expand nationally. And two of the co-founders, myself included, are market researchers by background. And so as part of our work, building and designing these workspaces in an inclusive fashion, it's really important for us to understand how we can continue to create inclusive spaces that are designed for belonging. So we have a research studio at the Coven that is called Empress. And that work is very much intended to be continually conducting research like this study that is intended for organizations that are interested in creating more inclusive cultures of belonging within their own organization. So you can find out more about the Coven at our website, which is thecoven.com. And you can also learn more about Empress and the research that we're doing and the subscriptions that we offer to access this research at empressinsight.com.
Liz, thank you so much for joining us and good luck to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Liz Giel, co-founder and partner with The Coven. And I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
This program is made possible by KBOO members.